Good morning, Mr. Robinson. Good morning, Ms. Baumgartner.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Are you ready on the matter of Sean White?
I am, Your Honor. I apologize for not being in here. I get a little nervous, so if I sit in here, my nerves are run all over the place. So.
No apology is necessary. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, if I could, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, Your Honor, Damon Robinson, representing petitioner LaShawn White. This appeal concerns three different issues, all revolving around the Fourth Amendment. The three issues that were raised on appeal, the first one is whether the petitioner's encounter with law enforcement was consensual in nature, or whether it was a stop, and whether there was any legal basis for the stop of the defendant. The second issue involves whether or not the defendant, the search of the defendant was consensual, and if it was consensual, whether or not he withdrew his consent by physically attempting to remove himself from the search of the officer. And the third one revolves around whether or not the girlfriend of the defendant, who was located in a hotel room, had apparent authority to search a bag belonging to the defendant while the defendant was not present in those matters. All these matters being Fourth Amendment, I think the court's decision revolves largely around the totality of the circumstances analysis. So a lot of the argument that I was presenting is one that is fact-based. And so I'll start off with the first issue, whether
Counsel,
or not. Yes.
Can I?
Absolutely.
Can I just direct you?
Absolutely.
Let me help you out a little bit. Can I just direct you to the last issue?
Absolutely. The last issue dealing with the bag, and I think the Glenn case, it was a Supreme Court case, provides a lot of direction to the court, and I think I cited that mostly in my brief for that proposition. Factually, if we look at the issue, the defendant, I don't think there's any equivocation about whether or not the bag belonged to the defendant or not. The girlfriend said it belonged to the defendant. She never in any manner stated that it belongs to both of them. The defendant never gave consent. There was no warrant present. So the issue largely revolves around, one, whether or not the police had any reason to believe that she had apparent authority to actually search that bag. I think it was cited in my brief, at least the argument made to the court, that I think that she had apparent authority to consent to the actual room, but not all of the belongings in the room, especially in a situation where she delineates ownership to someone other than herself. So it's a situation where the bag itself was in there. They specifically asked whose bag it was, and I'm assuming for the purposes of establishing, one, the ownership of the bag, and the fact that she says it's not my bag will let the police know that one, it's not her bag, and there may be some issue about whether or not she could actually give consent to search. In the Glenn case, they point to several things that I think is important in this case. One is there is an issue about whether or not, there's an issue where the court noted that there was no indicia of ownership of the bag. The defendant, although they told him that they were going to search, he didn't object to a search. But when they went upstairs, they looked at the bag itself did not have any signs of ownership. It could have been the homeowners. It could have been no one who was present at the residence. It could have belonged to the defendant.
Do we know what the defendant's relationship was to the room?
Not specifically. I think the evidence from the record states that my girlfriend is up in room, I think it was 219 was the room, and I don't know that the record's clear. I don't think the record's clear that he rented the room or that she rented the room, only that his bag was in the room and that the person who
Did
answered the door.
Did she have sole access and control over that bag?
I don't know if she had sole access over the bag. I mean, when they responded, she was the only person present at that time. There's no other information that there was anyone in the room other than her. It's unclear whether the defendant had access to the room. I mean, it's his bag. So
Now, did she make clear that it was his bag, or did she make clear that it wasn't hers?
I think she said it was his bag. I think it was specifically clear that it was his bag. She didn't say, it's not my bag. She said, it's his bag. And as such, I think, again, that delineates the holding or the ruling in the Glenn case where there was no ownership, there was no indicia of ownership. So in that case, they did not know whose bag it belonged to. And as such, again, we have a situation where the police know that the bag itself belongs to this defendant, not to the person who ultimately gave consent.
And counsel, had the officer not asked the question about the bag, your position is that Glenn would have allowed them to search the bag?
I think that would be more along the lines of the holding of Glenn. I mean, there was no indicia of ownership, and the defendant or the police officers not having any indication of who the hotel room was registered to. They didn't know if she was a registered guest, if he was a person who had rented it. I mean, they didn't have that information available to it at that time. So I think that would be along the lines of Glenn. I think that if the defendant, if they had asked the defendant whether or not they could search the room, or if they had asked the defendant or told him that they were going to search the room and he didn't object, again, that would be a closer along the lines of Glenn. But again, the defendant was not in a position where he could object. He was downstairs. They were on the second floor. He was in custody in a police vehicle. They did not make any did not make it known any intention that they were going to search the room. He did not ask them to search the room. He specifically asked them to go upstairs and inform his girlfriend that he was being arrested.
Did you know if that bag was open or closed?
And Your Honor, I think in my brief, I think I said closed, and when going back, I don't necessarily know that the bag was closed or there's any direct information concerning the structure of the bag.
You couldn't see through it, though.
Reading from it, that you could not see it. There was no information that the officer said, I saw through the bag. And specifically, I think in the questioning that what would have been along, it was a cross-examination of the suppression hearing. I think he said it was a bag, and then there was a gray bag inside that bag, and there was another bag there. So the bag that the bag was inside of, we don't know what it looks like. But he said he had searched the bag. He had asked for he did not ask the defendant to search the bag. He used the term search. I'm assuming that it was not a bag that he could just look in and see the belongings or the contents of the bag. But that was not clear. It was not made clear by counsel during the.
Can you address harmless error?
I do. I think largely, as the trial court looks at it, there was testimony. I believe it was Officer Sapp who was made the expert in this case, and it was a situation where he said that you know, absent those bags, he still believes that the items were inconsistent with personal use, and there was a lot of cross-examination regarding the amount of drugs and the amount of loan cannot have been inconsistency, whether it was broken out or not broken down. And the court, somewhere in that question, he says, I understand that what the defendant is saying about whether or not those, just the amount of drugs and it not being broken down would have been enough. And the argument is, I think I don't know if the removal of the scales, if the baggies, the sandwich bags, would prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Is that part of the expert's testimony, though, that aside from the quantity or the money or whatever, the fact there was a scale, bags, and capsules indicated that it was inconsistent with personal use? was the evidence seized from the bag part of his analysis or part of his opinion?
I think that, yeah, it was two parts. I think he first said that solely the drugs and the money, and I think there were two phones that he thinks is inconsistent personally use, and then he said, you know, also including the importance of, I think he used the word importance, of the baggies and the pill capsules, that goes to strengthen the argument that it was for distribution. And again, the court didn't provide any guidance into how much weight they gave each item. I mean, obviously the amount of drugs, there was a dispute about that, and then the use of cutting agents or no cutting agents and how that would factor into a court's decision of whether or not it was consistent or inconsistent with personal use. So obviously the court could have alone made the decision that without the capsules, without the bags, the item that recovered from the hotel, it could have made a decision. But we don't know what weight, if any, and we're talking about a beyond a reasonable doubt determination. The court could, again, removing the scales, removing baggies, all of those things, the court didn't give any indication of how much weight or lack of weight that it gave the consideration of the items that were recovered from the bag.
So, counsel, I assume that, well, I don't want to assume, let me ask you. Mm-hmm. If the court were to determine that the officer shouldn't have been able to look in the bag and we were to reverse it, I would assume you would expect us to reverse and remand.
If only on that issue, I think
just
that on that issue, I think that would be the appropriate ruling. We don't know again how much weight the court gave each one of those considerations dealing with personal use or distribution, and as such, you know, the fact finder could give all of the weight to the items in the bag or none of the weight to the items of the bag, and vice versa when determining, you know, the amount of drugs or not. So I don't think that while this court could, I don't know if this court should necessarily try to determine how much weight the trial court gave in assessing whether or not distribution, the indicia of distribution, would have been met without items that were considered by the trial court in reaching that decision. There was also, the initial stop. I know the court, I'll address those appeals like I have a little bit of time. I think there's mention of the McGee case in my brief, and I didn't dive into that. But again, when looking at the totality of circumstances, I do think that there is sufficient evidence that the court could find that the defendant was stopped for Fourth Amendment purposes without any sufficient evidence for him
Tell
being
me
detained.
How do you base that statement on?
Well, again, I think it's very close to the McGee case, and I think it's in the brief. I didn't cite it detail, but if the court looks at it, I think it's a 1997 case. But basically, you look at the number of the police officers present. There's three police officers. The position themselves, one in front of the defendant within arm's reach. One would have been kind of behind him. And there was another officer even further behind him on the other side of the car. So you have three officers. And there was a car, actually, the police car, behind the defendant. So basically he's in a situation where he's maybe kind of circled into an area. They made known that they're investigating the distribution of drugs. They take his identification. They run his identification. Doesn't come back. And under McGee case, it's a very similar factual situation where there's a call. They make known that they're investigating someone for selling drugs. They go to this defendant. A little bit different in McGee case. McGee case says we're investigating and you match the description, which we don't have necessarily in this case. But they say that you match the description, and you know, they basically do a pat down search of the defendant. Don't find anything. His hands are clenched. They say they think there may be a weapon in his hands. He unclenches his hands, and there that they find, I think, a small amount of what appeared to be cocaine. that at that time the court noted, one, the number of officers, the fact, I think, that they were armed. They also note the fact that officers, you know, didn't scream or didn't yell at this defendant, but that they identified themselves. The police officer said that they were investigating a drug distribution of drugs, and that they had received a call that he fit the description of the person that was doing it.
Well, these aren't the facts of that case.
Not exactly. I mean, they didn't specifically say, we suspect you. They didn't verbally say that, but again, there were three officers. They had their guns. They were holstered, identified themselves as a police officer, said that they was got a call that there was drug distribution in the area, and they asked him for consent, similar to what they did in the McGee case. So,
did they raise their voice?
No indication that they had raised their voice, that they didn't touch him. And all these things were things that were also similar in the McGee case. They didn't raise their voice. Only time that they touched him was doing the pat down. Is that the red light may stop, I'm assuming?
Yes, sir. We'll give you a little time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Susan Baumgartner for the Office of the Attorney General. I'll start with the motel room issue. It is the defendant's burden to prove that he had an objectively reasonable expectation of privacy, first and foremost, in that room. And that wasn't met. It was a hotel room, and therefore you need to be a registered occupant or sharing it with a registered occupant. There was no evidence in the record that Tanya was a registered occupant or that the defendant was ever inside that room. So she consented to the search of the room, and there's no reason to doubt her consent. The officer went in alone, he was in plain clothes, there's no evidence that he was threatening or accusatory, so she had the apparent authority to consent to the search. The real issue is simply about the gray plastic bag, and on page 136 of the record, where during the trial, admittedly, this evidence wasn't in the suppression hearing, but during the trial, Officer Sapp testified that it was a gray plastic bag sitting on the bed. Not something that necessarily was closed, certainly not a backpack, just a gray bag sitting on the
bed. But there's no evidence you could see through it.
There's no evidence either way. I mean, it could have been like a gray Home Depot bag that is somewhat translucent, but there's certainly no testimony that the officers, that Officer Sapp knew before he looked into the bag what it would contain.
And he asked about the bag, right?
It is, I don't recall whether he asked or whether she said, but before he went into the bag, I believe she did say that it belonged to the defendant.
And so how does the dicta in Glenn not control?
Well, Glenn, the issue is whether the police knew that the grandfather didn't own or use the backpack. It's not solely about who owns the item. And she was alone in the room with this gray plastic bag. She had full control over it. Also, Glenn talks about third-party consent. The third party has authority to consent if there's mutual use by virtue of joint access or control. And all indicia here were that she had joint access and control.
Well, joint access and control to the room, but certainly not to the bag. You said it's his bag.
She said he owned the bag, but that doesn't mean she didn't have joint access and control to the bag. She was alone with the bag.
What
she had
case supports that?
I would argue Glenn supports it just by the plain language of joint access and control, the same way various gun possession cases, various drug possession cases, the issue is custody and control as opposed to figuring out exact ownership of it. She had custody of the bag. There is no evidence that he ever had it. I mean, in the same way, she could have purchased something for him and said that belongs to him. Because her intention was for him to own it, but it was still under
custody. Did she give permission to search the bag?
She did not object to it.
But she didn't give specific permission?
She did not give specific permission to it. However, when she gave permission to the room, that included all closed containers. and she certainly didn't object to the bag. Nor did the defendant object when he sent the police to the room. He didn't make any objection about their searching anything.
Well, he didn't say, go tell her, and by the way, you can search the room.
No, he didn't. However, that's not the standard for objecting to...
Well, that's the standard for consent, though.
Correct. But I would argue that they didn't need his consent because she had full control over the bag and she granted consent for it to be searched.
And he didn't make any claim to a possessory interest in the room or whether he was staying there, and if so, how long, whether he'd even been an overnight guest there?
Correct. He didn't say anything about whether he'd even ever been upstairs. I mean, he knew where Tanya was, but there's no evidence that he had ever been in the room at all. There's no evidence that he brought the bag to the room. And if there are no more questions on that, I would like to address the harmless error prong, which is that Officer Sapp testified on page 145, essentially that the evidence in the room was merely confirmatory of what he already believed based on his expertise from the items recovered from the defendant himself in the parking lot. The defendant had a large amount of drugs on him. He had 6 grams of heroin.
But for us to find harmless error, wouldn't we have to conclude that the trial court in no fashion considered the items found in the bag?
I think you'd have to find beyond a reasonable doubt that it wouldn't have changed the trial court's decision.
And she specifically said she relied on the combination of evidence in finding the defendant guilty.
Well,
kind of hurts the harmless error.
Did she say the combination? I don't have that quote in front of me.
She used the specific word, combination of evidence.
But was the phrase the combination of evidence between the hotel room and the parking lot?
Well, that would be difficult to determine.
Well,
she said a few things.
Because there was a massive amount of evidence on his person. There was 6 grams of raw heroin worth over $500. It was packaged in 3 different weights, consistent with quantities sold. He had over $600 with him. It was separated out by denomination consistently with how drug dealers separate their cash. He had 2 cell phones on him. He had no paraphernalia for personal use of all these drugs. And the cops observed an apparent transaction of him with the woman in the car. And when he stepped away from the car, he had money in his hand. So I think under a combination, that's a combination of evidence as well. And I think
But she admitted the evidence of the bag.
Correct.
So here's what she said. It's the combination or the accumulation of all of the various factors that leave the court to conclude that beyond a reasonable doubt that the drugs that were recovered and the various other indicia of distribution to which Investigator Sapp testified are indicated that the amount of heroin Mr. White had on his person that day was inconsistent with personal use and consistent with distribution. So that was my question. I mean, she's a little bit confusing in terms of what that combination references and indicia of distribution. But under the standard, if we can't say for sure that she didn't consider it, we can't say it's harmless, can we? As confusing as she might have been.
Well, I do think, though, that the issue is whether, in determining whether it's harmless, I think the issue is determining whether it created harm, whether it would have changed the outcome. And I do think you can say that it would not have changed the outcome beyond a reasonable doubt.
How do we know that when she said that the evidence seized and the weight and the money and all that, plus all the other factors, led her to believe that there was intent to distribute?
Well, I do think those other...
How can we exclude... There was evidence, obviously, before her about scales and capsules and bags. How can we exclude that that wasn't part of her consideration? And wouldn't we have to do that to come up with a harmless error?
I don't think you have to find that it was not at all part of her consideration. I think you have to find that it would not have changed the verdict beyond a reasonable doubt. And the case law is replete with all these...
Counsel, I would agree with you if she said, motion overruled, I'm going to find the defendant guilty. But she went into a discussion of the basis for her findings. And when she does that, that gives us a bird's eye view of what she's considering, which would not be the case with a jury or with a judge that would simply rule.
I do think, though, her statement does not solely say of the combination of evidence. I don't think it's that clear that what she means is the drugs and the baggies as opposed to
the
money and the separation.
However unclear, we do know that she took other factors into consideration, right?
She did consider the totality of the circumstances, yes. Okay. But I do not think her verdict would have changed given the extremely strong evidence of distribution that was present on his person.
Is there a case where the court has applied harmless error in the context of a trial judge saying something to the effect of, I look at the combination of the evidence?
I am not aware of one off the top of my head.
Thank you.
And I would actually disagree in this case that should you find the error was not harmless, that it should necessarily be remanded. The court could also consider convicting him, I believe, of the possession, since there was the only element that length goes to is the distribution as opposed to the possession.
I think the Commonwealth's attorney might have a problem with that. But.
And as far as the, would you like me to address the parking lot search?
Judge Frank,
it's your case.
Right. The parking lot search, I think all evidence pointed to it, was consensual. He did not attempt to pull away from the police until after they had found the drugs. At that point, they had probable cause to retrieve them from his sock. If there are no further questions, I urge you to affirm.
Thank you.
Mr. Robinson, I promised you a little bit of time. We'll give you a couple minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you, and I'll make it as brief as I can. Every time I seem to say that in court, absolutely. There are a couple things I just wanted to point out factually. When we're talking about the actual bag, I think the description of the bag is on page 89 of the appendix, and in it the question was asked, did you look in the bag? I did you see anything in the bag? And the officer said, inside the bag I found a black plastic bag. Inside that bag contained a digital scale and a box containing plastic sandwich bags. Also inside was a gray plastic bag with a brown paper bag inside of that. And so it appears that there was a bag and there were several bags inside of that, all of which I think one saying he looked inside the bag lends itself to believe that, one, it wasn't something that was immediately apparent, and that it was something that he actually had to physically do something to look inside of the bag, which would constitute a search. I think that there was testimony that actually there was at trial, the testimony was it was 4.3 grams after the packaging had been removed, which again would lessen the amount of weight to the drugs and ultimately affect whether or not those drugs could or could not be consistent with distribution. Largely, I think that the argument as it goes to the sock issue, I think there is the playing field doctrine. I don't know necessarily that the officer had sufficient evidence to actually go into the sock and attempt to recover it. He said he felt a plastic bag and then it was a powdery substance. Whether or not that's sufficient to identify it as some illegal substance that he wasn't authorized to have, I don't know if the evidence supports that contention.
Counsel, can you address, and this is at the end of your time, but could you address counsel's position that essentially the consent to look in the bag was joint consent? It was the consent of the girlfriend just because she said it was the defendant's bag doesn't mean that she was withdrawing consent to search?
Well, as it goes to the consent, sir, I just don't believe that she had the consent. I think absent there being any question or ownership of who the bag was, I mean, the whole purpose, I think, of the language in Glenn was that they did not know who the bag belonged to. And if they did, it being possibility that it was two people's bag as opposed to one person's bag. But when she unequivocally denied any ownership or connection to the bag, it's different than if she had said the bag was mine and he asked me to hold it. The bag was both of ours. She specifically said the bag belonged to him, and I don't think that she can give consent to search the bag because it's located in the room no more than I could search, you know, your wallet or your purse if it's in the same room and I know it's there.
What about the standing point that he has no standing to challenge search of anything in the room?
It's his bag. I think that his ownership of it gives him the ability to have standing of is to have standing. I don't think the defendant has to, you know, have these multiple layers of, you know, ownership or interest in the room. He just has to have an interest in the item being searched. So that item is in another item, then if he has ownership of that item, then that gives him standing to object to it. And she says it's his bag, establishing his standing to object to the search of it.
What if I put my personal bag in a place where I otherwise have no reasonable expectation of privacy?
Well, I think that your bag, depending upon how it is, I think there are situations where it could be less an expectation of privacy. If you have a clear bag and you can see all the contents of it, it's different than if you have a bag where the items in it are concealed, because then that strengthens your expectation of privacy. Because obviously if it's covered or in some way not made apparent, then you can assume that that was your desire not to allow everyone to know what was in the bag by placing it in a manner which people could not tell what was in the bag. And so I think that if your bag is in a public place, you still have every expectation of privacy in it if people can't see what's inside the bag or know what's in the bag.
So if Judge Atlee leaves his gym bag out in the hallway in the courthouse, he has no expectation of privacy in it?
No, I think he does. I mean, I think it's his bag, and so he has I mean, if it's a clear book bag, like, you know, the kind of offer required to go into schools or through metal detectors, it's different than if the bag is not opaque. I mean, it's not clear, transparent, you can't see in it. I think he has a definite expectation of privacy in his bag
even though he abandons it in a public place.
Excuse me?
Even though he abandons it in a public place?
Well, I don't know if it was abandoned. I mean, it's different if it's in a hotel room that's obviously rented by someone, whether it's the defendant or not. We don't know that, but it's not abandoned. I think, you know, if you place your purse down in a restaurant and you go to the restroom, is different than if your bag is there for 10 hours and no one around your bag. So I think it's a situation where there's other factors other than simply whose bag it is that establishes whether or not there's privacy interest in it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Come down and greet counsel, then we'll be in recess.